Chapter 6. The tail belonged to Kurucci Voda's race, but it was Fulgrim who took center stage to tell it. Never at ease with others sharing the limelight, the Phoenician had become narcissistic to the point of egomania, Perturabo saw. He watched Fulgrim as he circled theatrically, the great actor promenading before delivering his greatest soliloquy. Fulgrim took up a heroic pose, more like an actor pretending to be him than himself. "Brothers and sisters," began Fulgrim with a deep bow, "I come before you all to tell a tale of forgotten days, of lost empires and an age of the galaxy before the rise of mankind. We rule now where an ancient race once claimed dominion, and though it declines to its inevitable doom, there are still remnants of its empire's lost glory in the secret places of the galaxy. Listen well, and I will transport you through the mists of time to the last days of this decadent race." Fulgrim's words were delivered with panache and the precise variation in tone to hook the imagination of the audience. To Perturabo's ears, they were needlessly ostentatious and took twice the time to tell as was required. Whatever the story to come, Perturabo knew he could tell it with more economy and clarity, but those were two concepts Fulgrim appeared to have left behind in his headlong plunge into whatever obsession was driving him. He stood with his arms folded as Fulgrim stalked the stage like a prowling killer, his pallid flesh and ebony eyes sweeping the crowd as though searching for something. Fulgrim lifted one arm to the sky. "We begin in a time before time, when mankind was yet to crawl on his belly from the primordial waters to the mud of the shore. We were not yet worthy to inherit the mantle of gods, for another race claimed that honour, and the universe does not permit more than one pantheon to name itself divine. The children of Asurion they were, wrought from the fiery flesh of their godhead and cast into the galaxy like seeds from a ploughman's hand. They called themselves Eldar, and their empire stretched from one side of the Monoceros ring to the other, from Perseus to the farthest reach of Scutum Centaurus. Their empire was mighty and proud, for their gods had granted them the means to travel the length and breadth of their realm in the blink of an eye. The warrior kings, Eldanesh and Ulthanesh, led their armies in wars of conquest that saw every foe who dared stand before them brought low. And yet, even with the entirety of the galaxy as their domain, the selfish Eldar were not satisfied. Eldanesh wept for the emptiness of his playground, and Isha, the whore goddess from whose bleeding loins the Eldar had sprung, shed bitter tears that brought fresh life to the galaxy. Her grief was a wellspring of creation that brought many new and wondrous races into being. All for the amusement of her children, an act of such foolish indulgence that it beggars belief." Perturabo watched Kurucci Voda as Fulgrim spoke, and though his hood was still raised, it was possible to see the effect the storytelling was having upon him. With each pejorative mention of the Eldar, a muscle in Voda's face would twitch, a nervous tick that would have been invisible to any perception save that of a Primarch. Whatever the audience might be feeling towards Fulgrim's tale, Voda was not enjoying it. Fulgrim circled the amphitheatre, his voice mellifluous, a euphony of sound that was unwillingly drawing Perturabo into the web of characters and plots as Fulgrim gave name to Eldar heroes and kings, their great thinkers and, of course, their enemies. What drama would be complete without a nefarious evil to oppose? "As all here know, power begets jealousy, and the king of the conquered Haresh Selene race plotted and schemed in the darkest reaches of the galaxy." As Fulgrim gave name to this king, he stooped and rubbed his hands together like a children's tale-teller making a pantomime of villainy. The effect was laughable, yet the crowds in the tiers responded with jeers and howls of outrage. Perturabo was dumbfounded at the reaction his brother's manipulative words were having, yet even he had to confess to a mounting interest in the legendary tale being woven around him. The armies of Hresh Selene, rebuilt in secret and scattered in dimensions beyond the reach of the Eldar, finally assembled and struck back at their conquerors. With their king at their head, the Hresh Selene slaughtered the Eldar by the tens of thousands in battles that left entire regions of the galaxy uninhabitable for millennia. The Eldar were mighty, yes, and their warriors peerless, but the armies of the Hresh Selene outnumbered the stars, and though each battle saw the dead number in the millions, it was but a drop in the ocean to the full might of their grotesque battle hosts. Fulgrim had by now unsheathed his sword, and the golden blade drew fresh gasps of astonishment and roars of approval. Fulgrim spun and leapt like a dancer, yet Perturabo saw the fierce skill in his every move, the lethal grace that had made his brother a matchless swordsman, beyond even the technical ability of Gilliman or the enraged purity of Angron. The Eldar were on the verge of defeat, and the gods wept to see their favoured children so humbled. Once again, Eldanesh cried for his mother goddess to aid him, and she was shamed enough by his pleas to beg her brother husband, the war god Kayla Menchakane, to fight alongside the Eldar. Kane refused, for he had ever been jealous of Azurian's brood and relished the sight of their pain. But when Isha offered him the sanctity of her once virgin flesh, the war god relented and took what she offered without heed for her life. No sooner had he planted his bloody seed in Isha's belly than a fiery avatar tore its way from her womb with claws of blood and a hunger for destruction beyond even the war god's power to unleash. Perturabo felt the audience's terror at the idea of so monstrous a creature, though what the allegory of legend actually meant in terms of real history was impossible to tell. Isha's death scream was her war child's birth scream, a battle cry that stilled the very heart of the galaxy in fear and echoes in the hearts of all who spill blood to this day. The Eldar knew this being as Melsha Ayla Therachia, a name unspoken by their race, but which lives in their withered hearts as a gnawing fear. "What does the name mean, brother?" asked Perturabo. "I know the tongue of the Eldar, but those words are unfamiliar to me." Fulgrim paused in the telling of the tale, his face a brittle mask that looked to be on the edge of violence at this interruption.
"It is an ancient name, my lord," said Karuchi Vora. "One never spoken aloud. It means the beautiful eagle from hell that brings the end of all things, which translates imperfectly as
the angel exterminatus," finished Perturabo.
"Then might I continue?" snapped Fulgrim, still poised on the brink of hostility. Perturabo nodded, and Fulgrim slipped back into the tale as though he had not spoken. "The angel exterminatus joined the fight against the Hresh Selene, and mighty were the slaughters it wreaked across the galaxy. Eldanesh welcomed its aid, even as he realized his own cowardice had caused the death of his mother goddess. Ulthanesh was broken by the price they had paid for this newborn creature of destruction, a beautiful creature that inspired love and terror in equal measure. Truly, the angel exterminatus was an Eldar demigod like no other, blessed with the most beguiling countenance, the greatest strength and the highest intellect. What the gods knew, it knew, and what power they feared to wield, it unleashed with a song in its heart. While Ulfanesh quailed at the power of the angel exterminators, Eldanesh grew to love the stink of blood in his nostrils, the smell of charred flesh, and the sight of carrion picking the flesh of the dead. He grew jealous of the power so casually wielded by the angel exterminators and plotted to bring it to ruin once the war against the Haresh Selain was done. Yet, even as his people's enemies retreated in the face of the angel exterminators, Eldanesh's desire to utterly destroy the Haresh Selain grew to become an obsession. Only the total extinction of his foes would satisfy such bloodlust, and he bade the angel exterminators to craft weapons that would wipe their worlds from time and memory. Blind to Eldanesh's madness, the angel exterminators agreed, and forged weapons of such power that their very concept drove those who learned of them to take their own lives, rather than live in a galaxy where such things were conceived. Now Perturabo's interest was well and truly snared. Whether this was embellished allegory or wild fantasy didn't matter. This was the heart of the matter, and the crux upon which his indulgence hung. To fashion such weapons was no little matter, said Fulgrim, and the angel exterminatus was weakened by their creation, for much of its power was bound into their destructive hearts. Exhausted by its labours, it sank into a great slumber on an ancient battleground, leaving Eldanesh to revel in what it had created. But Eldanesh saw what the angel exterminatus had wrought, and despaired, for he now understood that such weapons were an abomination. The veils of his madness parted, and he saw what he had become and what he had lost in his quest for victory. He summoned Ulfanesh to his side, and offering great prayers to Azurian, they sought to banish the angel exterminatus to the netherworlds, beyond the walls of space and time, and consign it to the hells from whence it had been conceived. Sensing their intent, the angel awoke from its rest and fought back. Fulgrim hacked his sword through the air as he spoke, each stroke theatrically desperate, as though he fought for his life against unseen opponents that were steadily wearing him down. Breathless and dishevelled, Fulgrim dropped to one knee, his golden sword held out before him, a perfect rendition of a beleaguered hero, bowed but unbroken. Perturabo had long since tuned out the more mythic elements of the tale, focusing instead on what the truth behind the legend might be. Fulgrim rose unsteadily to his feet, as though pushing against an invisible force that sought to keep him down. Such a battle had never yet been seen in the ages of the galaxy. A being with the power of a god, assailed by its wayward heirs, and no mercy was to be found in their hearts as blood flowed, and the very warp and weft of the galaxy was torn asunder by the violence of their conflict. None now live who remember how long these demigods fought. But against the power of the angel exterminatus, Eldanesh and Ulfanesh could not hope to prevail. Both were driven to their knees and faced the final wrath of the very thing they had helped to create. But before the angel exterminatus could slay them, Asurian himself intervened to save his foolish sons. The angel exterminatus was a god, but Asurian had ruled the heavens for an age before it had sprung from Isha's bloody carcass, and his power was terrible to behold. He finished what Eldanesh and Ulfanesh had begun, and ripped the galaxy apart, folding the tortured skeins of space and time around the angel exterminatus, and sealing it away in a prison from which there could be no escape, and no reprieve from the terror it had unleashed. Perturabo hid his scorn at such a deus ex machina ending to the legend, but as Fulgrim cast his eyes heavenwards, he knew what was coming next. "Behold, the ancient prison of the Angel Exterminatus!" screamed Fulgrim, thrusting his blade towards the fallout-racked clouds. Though kilometres thick, a halo of light parted them for long enough for the night's blackness to become visible. And in that slice of darkness, the ugly bruise of the Star Maelstrom.
Range confirmation? 506 meters.
Sharokin used the tip of his right thumb to minutely adjust the focus of his sight. The position he had selected was an optimum kill site, in line with prevailing winds to prevent projectile drift that would alter his shot's trajectory. Thermo-auguries on his cooled rifle sheath measured the surrounding temperature and blinked a correction to compensate for what lift the warm air would impart to the large-bore steel needle. Likewise, the strength of the planet's geomagnetic field factored into Sharokin's calculations when deciding upon the angle of his shot. In his mind's eye, any conventional target was already dead, but a Primarch was no conventional target.
"As soon as I take this shot, we go," said Sharokin. "We get out, and we get out fast, even if I miss. You understand?"
"I understand," said Wayland. "Don't worry, I won't go berserk and charge in single-handed."
Sharokin sighted on his target's skull, slowing his heart rate and letting his breathing even out as he applied the tiniest pressure to the trigger. Ready icons winked to life on his helm, a dotted line tracing the route his needle would take, right through a Primarch's eye.
"Taking the shot," he said.
The crowd bayed at the sight of the leering smear of unlight and tortured space-time in the heavens, and Perturabo despised them for their easily bought wonder. They had no idea the danger it represented, the dreadful insidious canker that wormed its way into the heart. Like a wasting sickness of the soul, its appearance abraded all joy and all life from those who saw it, and Perturabo had seen it for a very long time indeed.
"The great Star Maelstrom!" cried Fulgrim, like a fiery preacher of a bygone age. "A wound ripped in the galaxy to imprison a godlike being by a race who would not accept that their time was at an end. This is where the greatest glory and the greatest shame of the Eldar lies, bound by chains that Asurion decreed never be undone until the end of the universe itself. And so it has been. From that day to this..."
Fulgrim paused, savouring the deliciousness of what he was about to say, and letting the moment of anticipation build until Perturabo feared the audience might riot if he kept silent much longer.
"But Asurion is forgotten, his people broken by their own weaknesses, and we pay no heed to the decrees of a failed god. The way is open for those with the boldness to act."
Fulgrim sheathed his sword, his eyes fevered, his skin sheened in perspiration. His chest heaved with the effort of storytelling, as though he had played host to the spirit of Thalia herself. Perturabo saw through the fiction of his exhaustion, knowing his brother was playing to the crowd's expectation and the grandeur of the amphitheatre.
"While the Angel Exterminator sleeps, we will storm Asurion's jail and take for ourselves the weapons forged in ancient times," roared Fulgrim.
Perturabo saw the tiny puff of blood appear on Fulgrim's skull a second before he heard the crack of the shot. Fulgrim's black eyes rolled back into his skull.
"No!" cried Perturabo, as his brother dropped to the flagstones of the arena, his ashen face masked with blood.
"Go!" shouted Sharokin, already moving and collapsing the long-range scope of the carbine. He turned and ran for the shadowed cloister of statues that ringed the outer circumference of the great amphitheatre as pandemonium erupted behind them. Baying cries of horror and anger echoed all around them, amplified tenfold by the structure's acoustical genius, but neither Sharokin nor Wayland had time to savour them.
The hunters would already be on their trail. "Did you kill him?" asked Wayland as they reached their exit point, where coiled lengths of high tensile wire were hidden in the shadows. "I hit him where I meant to," said Sharokin, looping his wire around the neck of a goddess statue before attaching it to a metal ring on his armour. "Whether that's enough to kill him is another matter. Drop now, talk later." Both warriors turned back to face the centre of the amphitheatre, balancing on the lip of a carved stone ledge, hundreds of metres above the ground. "Ready?" asked Sharokin. "Ready," confirmed Wayland. "Drop!" Sharokin pushed out from the ledge and fell in a curving parabola down the face of the building. He controlled the rapid descent with his heavy-duty gauntlets, slamming back into the face of the structure halfway down. Marble cracked beneath his boots and fell in a splintered white rain to the ground below. Wayland was still higher than him, his jumps shorter. Sharokin jumped again, turning in mid-flight to face the ground as it rushed towards him. Crowds were already flooding from the amphitheatre in a panic. Perhaps they feared Imperial retribution, a war fleet that had approached in secret and not fallen foul of betrayal. Would that were the case, thought Sharokin. Shots rang out, blasting chunks from the carved bas-relief above him, and he saw three warriors in the dull, unpainted armour of the Iron Warriors with their weapons trained upwards. Sharokin arrested his descent as he snapped the wire from the metal ring. He fell the last 20 metres to the ground, landing with his weapon unlimbered and ready to fire. He dropped to one knee and put a burst of needles through the visor of the nearest iron warrior. The traitor fell without a sound, and Sharokin put a single tox round through the grilled faceplate of the next before rolling aside as a tearing blast of bolter fire chewed up where he'd landed. Another rapid spray of needles punched through the thin neck joint of the third iron warrior, and blood sheeted down his bare metal breastplate as he toppled. Wayland crashed to the ground next to him, and Sharokin winced at the awkwardness of the Iron Hand's landing. "A Korovane novitiate has more grace in the air than you, brother," said Sharokin. Wayland grunted a reply and ran south as the sounds of panic spilled from the amphitheatre with the baying mobs of enemy followers and warriors. Sharokin set off after him, following the course they had plotted en route to their clandestine observation of the two traitor primarchs. What had been planned as a fact-hunting mission had become one of assassination. They moved through the debris of the theatre's ultra-rapid construction, a city of vast spoil heaps, trenches, material stores and towering construction engines. Abandoned worker camps and supply depots flashed past on either side as they made their escape. Amid the sounds of terror surrounding the amphitheatre, Sharokin heard the unmistakable sounds of pursuit. A life lived behind enemy lines had given him a preternatural sense for being hunted. For all that he hated the traitors and all they had done, he didn't forget that these were warriors of the legions. They were just as deadly and just as proficient as any of the Emperor's warriors. But they had never fought a Raven Guard and an Iron Hand like this. "They're coming!" he shouted to Wayland. "Blowing the first charge!" A thunderous detonation shook the ground as Wayland triggered the first of many explosives seeded along their escape route. A cascade of dirt and broken body parts rained down as the echoes of the thermic charge faded. Sharokin skidded to a halt behind an overturned skip loader, resting his rifle on the battered metal lip of the hopper. A mob of men and women in garish robes emerged from the shadow of a heap of discarded rock debris, and Sharokin put the first six down with as many shots. The rest faltered in their advance, but kept coming even as he killed another five. "Displace!" ordered Wayland. Sharokin snapped up his rifle and ran. Screams of hate erupted at the sight of him, and a ragged volley of poorly aimed shots chased him down. A chugging blast of bolter fire ripped through the mob, tearing a handful to shreds and blowing limbs from yet more. Where Sharokin's fire was more efficiently lethal, the savage roar of Wayland's bolter cowed the mortals more effectively. Sharokin reached Wayland's position behind a piled heap of steel rebar cages and slapped his shoulder guard, taking up a covering position as he heard the roar of engines and the thunder of booming footsteps that shook the earth. "Rhinos," he said. "No, land raiders," answered Wayland.
"They're looking to box us in," said Sharokin. "We need to keep moving."
"Agreed.
go, said Shadowkin, shouldering his rifle as the weight of fire intensified around them. Wayland ran for the narrow cut between two pyramidal heaps of broken stone and loose rubble. Shots burst around Shadowkin, and fragments scored his armour as the angry roar of a madly revving engine echoed from somewhere nearby. Shadowkin! Shouted Wayland as another buried explosive ripped through their pursuers. Cover me! He shouted back. Bolter shots punched through the screaming mob, and Shadowkin ran to join Wayland. He risked a backwards glance in time to see a pair of land raiders crest a metallic dune and crash back down with earth-shattering slams of iron. Their hulls were maddening swirls of purple and pink, organically scaled as though clad in serpent skin. Glistening banners trailed from their topsides, and smoke dispensers trailed a mist of iridescent fumes in their wake. The sight of them was so bizarre that Shadowkin's step faltered at their appearance. It was a hesitation that saved his life. Flaring beams of incandescent lasfire pulverized the stack of rubble ahead of him, sending a column of ash and steel mushrooming skywards. Shadowkin was hurled through the air and landed hard on stacked entrenching tools. He rolled back to his feet and set off again as another syncopated blast blew out the ground behind him. Shadowkin dropped into a wide trench bedded with rail tracks as shots spanked from the stone and earth, and the rapid spray of heavy-caliber bolters soared the air. One shot clipped the edge of his breastplate and spun him around. He rose, kept running. He looked up to see bulky figures in Legion warplate moving along the top ridges of stone and excavated earth either side. Mass reactive fire stitched the earth around him, but the stealth upgrades worked into his battle armor were throwing off the targeting mechanisms of the enemy guns. That's what happens when you rely on machines and not a good eye. A shot punched down into his shoulder guard, and he stumbled, weaving left and right as the screaming roar of the land raiders swelled behind him. He heard steelwork groan and buckle, the screech of tracks tearing over debris, and the coughing howl of engines. The wide trench opened out into a circular materials depot, heaped with blocks of shaped stone. Permacrete in moisture-proof vacuum sacks, steel reinforcement towers, and rows of giant pipes the size of a Titan's gun barrels. "Find cover," said Wayland's voice in his helmet. "Now!" Shadowkin ran for the wide-mouthed pipes, each twice as tall as his stooped-over height, and threw himself inside. He pressed himself flat against one curved wall. "Boom!" said Wayland. A cataclysmic detonation shook the world with seismic force. Atmosphere compressed and burst as a pressure wave pummeled its way along the pipe, crushing Shadowkin to the wall. Hammering echoes of secondary explosions crackled and thumped, and he felt the auto-senses of his armour resetting in the wake of the pounding sound waves and blinding glow. The pipe was concertinaed and warped as though it had been stepped on by a battle engine, and light broke in through cracks in the steelwork. Shadowkin picked himself up and ran towards the far end, checking his rifle was clear of obstructions. A shape appeared, silhouetted at the end of the tunnel, bulky, armoured and post-human. Shadowkin's weapon was already at his shoulder, and he put a single toxin shot into the target's centre mass. The warrior crumpled with a strangled cry, and Shadowkin vaulted the body, only vaguely noticing the hideous facial disfigurements and the strange long-necked weapon he carried. Reaching the end of the tunnel, Shadowkin backed up against the buckled steelwork of the pipe, ducking a head out to see what was going on. It wasn't good. The enemy had reacted far faster than they'd expected. Iron warriors and emperor's children were circling around to form an unbreakable perimeter. Gangs of soldiers in khaki uniform spread methodically through the construction site, sweeping the area with a thoroughness that surprised him, until he saw they were Seleucid Thorakites. Here and there, Shadowkin saw the bulkier shape of traitor legionaries bellowing orders or directing their charges with a clubbing blow. Shadowkin took a moment to listen, trying to gain some sense of whether he had the dubious honour of being the first Imperial servant to succeed in killing a traitor Primarch. Some wailing voices claimed to have seen Fulgrim's head split open by the killer's bullet. while others claim the wounded Primarch himself was leading the hunt for his would-be assassin. The truth was impossible to know, and he didn't have time to stick around and sort fact from fiction. The enemy couldn't have closed the noose just yet. He still had time, but only if he moved now. Shurikin ducked out of the pipe and made his way farther from the amphitheatre, moving where the darkness aided him, embracing shadows where the harsh beams of searchlights passed over him. Every metre he gained was a victory, but he was running out of space and time to manoeuvre as more and more warriors flooded the construction yards. "Wayland, are you there?" he hissed over the vox. "I could use some more backup here." Static buzzed from the speakers in his helmet, and he wondered if Wayland had been caught and killed in the moment since triggering the charges. The Iron Hand didn't have his flair for stealth work, nor had he trained in Raven Guard escape and evasion techniques. Shurikin owed Wayland his life after he pulled his wounded body onto a gunship on Istvan V, and the thought of that debt going unpaid left a bitter taste in his mouth. Shurikin pushed onwards, crawling through pools of stagnant oil-polluted water, beneath heavy lifter rigs and between stacked building materials. He ran along the edge of a high-walled ravelin, its interior stacked with coiled razor wire, bladed sawbucks, and other tools of the besieger. He heard the creak of a footfall an instant before he realized there was someone behind him, and dived forwards as a squealing blast of sonic force blasted a meter-wide hole in the modular plascrete wall. He rolled and brought his rifle up, pressing down on the trigger and emptying the solid needle magazine in the time it took to aim. His shots pierced the Emperor's Children Warrior's breastplate and misted his chest in a mass of pulped flesh. The legionary laughed hysterically and brought his weapon to bear again. "You only get one chance," said Shurikin, dropping his rifle and drawing his two shoulder-sheath gladii. Each black blade was a slice of utter darkness, non-reflective and near frictionless. Shurikin leapt, and his first blade sliced through the warrior's sonic weapon. The second buried itself in his neck. And still he wouldn't die. Shurikin wrenched his blades clear as the warrior opened his distended jaws impossibly wide. He'd thought the warrior's monstrous appearance was a hideously carved helmet, but now saw the error of that assessment. Nightmarish surgeries had transformed his enemy into something less than human, a parody of what evolution had wrought over millions of years and deemed fittest for survival. He screamed with deafening volume, and though Shurikin silenced him with a blade thrust that punched through the back of his plasticized skull, the damage was done. The enemy had a fix on his position. Shurikin sheathed his blades and scooped up his rifle, running for the edge of the construction site. More gunfire puffed the earth, and more screams of the hideously transformed warriors echoed around him. Shurikin climbed to the top of an earthen ridge, violating the cardinal rule of skylining himself, and looked for a way out. There wasn't one. He ducked back as more gunfire punched the ridgeline and dropped to his haunches as a host of mortal soldiers and traitor legionaries converged on his position. Four glistening land raiders rolled into sight, followed by a dozen Iron Warriors rhinos. Traitors disembarked with grim efficiency, marching towards their trapped prey. Shurikin slotted home his last clip of solid needles and scrambled back up the slope as more gunfire stabbed towards him. Lasburns scorched his armour, and damage indicators flickered angrily on his helmet visor. He turned and brought his rifle to bear, each shot pitching an enemy warrior to the ground. He saw crew-served guns being wheeled into place, quad lasers, small-caliber howitzers, tunnelling mortars. At least 1,000 enemy soldiers surrounded him, intent on taking him alive and making him pay for what he'd done. "Damn, but they're making sure," he said. Shurikin heard the roaring of engines behind him, the throaty intake of hot air being gulped into powerful vectored ramjets. A storm of dust devils blew up around him as a multispectrally camouflaged gunship rose up behind the ridge on throbbing banks of jetwash. Coloured a dull midnight grey, its swept back wings bristled with cannons, and its stubby prow with linked banks of heavy bolters. Missile racks on its upper fuselage locked into place with a clatter of loading mechanisms. The Storm Eagle dipped its tapered nose, and Shadokin saw Sabic Weyland in the cockpit. Weyland nodded, and Shadokin dropped flat as a hurricane of shells blitzed down the slope, shredding anything living in a storm of explosive, mass-reactive shells and armor-busting penetrator rounds. The traitors scattered as the nose of the Storm Eagle swung left and right, turning the ground below Shadokin into a boiling cauldron of hot metal and chewed-up flesh. The noise was incredible. A never-ending hellstorm of chugging bangs, rotating ammo hoppers, and clinking shell casings falling in a brass rain. The enemy land raiders weathered the storm of gunfire, but Weyland wasn't done. Four missiles detached from their mountings and slashed down at the heavily armored vehicles. Three of the tanks detonated instantly, blooming fireballs immolating the soldiers who'd taken shelter behind them. A fourth lurched like a wounded animal, crushing Emperor's children beneath its flaming bulk, before internal explosions blew it apart from the inside. The quiet that followed was like the aftermath of a terrible accident, the stunned silence before true horror kicks in. Shadokin used that moment to scramble up the slope towards the Storm Eagle. The assault gunship hovered on a cushion of superheated air that turned the top of the ridge to glass. The barrels of its rapid-firing cannons bled heat and drooled smoke. Its assault ramp slammed down, and Shadokin wasted no time in leaping aboard. "Go!" he shouted as he slammed a palm into the closing mechanism. The Storm Eagle spun on its axis, furiously nimble, and Shadokin was hurled against the fuselage as Weyland punched the engines. The gunship dropped and flew close to the earth as it jinked and wove an evasive pattern through the siege works. Shadokin struggled to reach the cockpit, dragging himself along via handholds on jutting stanchions and crew harnesses. He dropped into the co-pilot's seat, seeing the red earth and rocky mountains swinging wildly through the armor-glass canopy. "You cut that one fine," he said. "If you'd kept up with me, I wouldn't have had to," returned Weyland. Shadokin shrugged, unwilling to argue the point as the gunship's wild maneuvering threaded a path through waving streams of anti-aircraft fire. Weyland's hands danced over the controls, flaring the engines, pumping out targeting decoys in their wake, and avoiding the most predictable flight paths. The Storm Eagle's agility was far greater than any Legion aircraft Shadokin had flown in, and its stealth capabilities ensured that none of the coordinated fire patterns of the Iron Warriors came close to touching it. As the craft powered away from the valley, its madly twisting course was replaced by something approaching level flight. "We're clear?" he asked. "Their own gunships will be scrambling, but they'll not catch us before we're back aboard the Sisypheum," said Weyland. "What about their orbital launches?" The Iron Hand snorted in derision. "You're sure about that?" "Of course I'm sure," said Weyland. "I designed the Nighthawk pattern, remember?" Shadokin grinned and rapped his knuckles on the edge of the armoured bucket seat. "You know, Sabic, I think the Mechanicum might give this variant their seal of approval after all," he said.
"Yes?"
"Yes," said Shadokin. "Eventually.